Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Ira Harris and John Brown. Ira is an independent floor trader, successful hedge fund manager, a global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He was the CME director from 1997 to 2003. And John is the senior market strategist for Euro-Pacific Capital. He's a distinguished former member of Britain's Parliament who served on the Treasury Select Committee as chairman of the Conservative Small Business Committee and also as a principal advisor to the British government on issues relating to geopolitical matters. Margaret Thatcher. And he's worked for Morgan Stanley as an investment banker, also worked for other firms, Barclays Bank and Citigroup. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you very much, Russell. Hello. And to Ira,
thanks,
too.
Thanks, Richard. Yeah, John, hello to you. And thank you, Richard, for having us.
Great.
Putting this together.
So I thought we'd begin with a discussion on the Chinese oil contract and just a general theme for today's discussion are undercurrents geopolitically that are happening, which could have implications and factors on the financial markets and the economy. Ira, you've recently written that on this new crude oil futures contract that is priced in yuan and convertible to gold. You wrote, China's ability to monetize gold is a direct assault on the U.S. ability to manipulate the global financial system to its advantage, a remnant of the Bretton Woods post-World War II global system. Any thoughts on that? What do you think?
Well, you know, as we've had the breakdown of the system, and that's, you know, this is all part and parcel of what's taking place. And people who don't want to admit to themselves that there are just major changes afoot. You know, we see what China is doing, and I'm not making a qualitative judgment one way or another. That's just, you know, history. And again, you know, I just finished reading a book by Giovanni Arrighi, you know, who people might find fault with him, that he's on the left, but the long 20th century. And it was, there are just changes going on, and there's always changes going on in the international system. And the United States is seeing itself diminished as a global, as the global hegemon, to use, you know, a Chinese phrase. So these things are taking place, and the Chinese, who are very astute global watchers. You know, Richard, you and I have talked about this, and I know, I think we got into it last time, that when NAFTA started in January 1st, 1994, on the day that NAFTA started, China devalued the yuan from 5.8 to 8.7, where they held it for a long time after that. But that was a 50% devaluation. The Chinese are very astute watchers of the world situation, and this is just more of that.
And, John, you have also written about the same subject, about huge ramifications and a move that was little noticed outside of the financial world.
Yes. Well, interestingly enough, of course, Saudi Arabia and first of all, China is now the largest consumer of oil in the world, number one consumer. And its two largest suppliers are Saudi Arabia and Russia. So it's very interesting. Just that fact alone is quite interesting when you think of the Saudi visit to Russia. But what recently happened, and it's amazing that it missed most of the financial media, China created a domestic oil contract that will be traded internationally in yuan, the Chinese commercial currency. And that one will be convertible into gold. In other words, people that receive one for their oil, like Saudi Arabia or Russia or any other country that sells them oil, maybe even Britain, will be paid in one, not dollars. This is the crucial thing, because what happened in, Ira referred to after Bretton Woods, was the reserve, the dollar became the reserve currency, and most commodities in the world had to be priced in dollars. If it was a German, you had to buy dollars in order to buy pork bellies in the Chicago Exchange, etc. And what was most interesting was in the early 1970s, when the oil crisis happened, Dr. Kissinger flew into Saudi Arabia and managed to get to persuade the Saudis to persuade the rest of OPEC to only sell oil for dollars. In other words, no longer would sterling be any good or any other currencies to buy oil. Their oil was only to be sold for dollars. And that, of course, underpinned the US dollar and enabled the enormous expansion of dollar liquidity once Nixon had broken the gold window in August of 1971. And underpinned it. Now, this very interesting thing here, because now Saudi Arabia that's stuffed full of dollars, and other countries that's stuffed full of dollars, particularly China, but say Saudi Arabia sells oil for one, now to be paid, rather than dollars, and it can convert those one into gold. So that's very attractive for all oil exporters to be exporting to China in its Chinese currency, because unlike dollars, it convertible into gold. And this strikes exactly at what Ira was saying, the hegemony of the United States, the power that it was in 1944 at Bretton Woods. It was by far the most powerful economy in the world and the richest country. And then by 1945, the most powerful military nation on earth. And it's traded on that ever since. And if you look at the depreciation of the dollar, since 1914, when the Federal Reserve Board opened its doors in January 1914, the dollar has depreciated by some 98% or more. In other words, 2 cents of that dollar would buy you a present-day dollar. And sterling has been even worse, because there were $8 to the sterling pound in those days. Now there's 1.2. just over. And so you can see that sterling has virtually been depreciated over 99%. And yet nobody's noticed it, because all the other currencies have depreciated too, or most of them, because they've all been valued in dollars, not in gold. And that particularly happened after 1971. And that's when the real amazing scam took place. And today we're left with a world of seeming wealth, but really just huge liquidity. There are dollars swimming everywhere, hence these stock markets are rising. People got to put them to work, or you've got negative real interest rates. I mean, the interest rates in the U.S. are about 1.5%, and the inflation rate is just over 2%. And so there's a negative interest rate in the United States as well. And we've reached ridiculous things, that people finding somewhere to put their money, even into junk bonds. I mean, in 2009, a junk bond traded at 25, a European junk bond traded at 25% interest yield or yield. Today, it yields less than a 10-year U.S. Treasury bill. I mean, it's 2.2 as opposed to 2.3. And that can't go on. I mean, that just doesn't make sense. And it's a vast, vast bubble that when it's pricked eventually, and one got little worries about it. I think Trump's done a wonderful job in trying to drain this swamp and everything. But when he was in Puerto Rico, he said, we may wipe out Puerto Rican debt. But you see, if he wipes out Puerto Rican debt, and we have great sympathy for these poor people who've been completely cheated by their local government and their electrical system, pathetic state even before the storm. But if that happens, people start saying, well, what about Illinois? What about California? What about New York? The government going to wipe their debts? Should I be buying that? And eventually, if you extend that argument still further, say, well, what about America? Maybe a president comes in here and said, we'll wipe out the debt. So you start to get a real beginning of a fear as to whether I should be buying A, to have dollars, or B, to be buying U.S. debt. And that is the beginning of the pricking of this vast balloon, in my opinion.
Ira, thoughts on that?
I agree with everything that John has said, especially that chart is, when you look at the European high yield index, that yields less than U.S. 10-year treasuries, considered to be the safest debt in the world. If you don't think you have a problem, you must be a central banker. This is an enormous problem. And, of course, you know, right now the world marches on, but, you know, so be it. That's the way the markets work. And of course, we know that central banks, and I think we'd all agree, have broken the signaling mechanism of what bond markets are supposed to do. So where they would be offering us warning signals, they can't, because you can't overcome that power of the their proverbial, and it's more proverbial, it's an actual printing press, where they can print and print and print. And we know that money in a world in which capital flows freely, all money is fungible. There's nothing to stop it. When you buy $60 billion a month in Europe, that money goes somewhere. And it goes to buy other assets. And so they're buying all types of bonds. So we don't have a market price. And we know that the central banks are the biggest fear is for them, for the market to take over the pricing mechanism, because then it would reflect some sense of reality. As long as the central banks control it, then we don't have a sense of that reality. So, I mean, that's just the world in which we live in. And I think that John is 100% right, especially in what the Chinese want to do here. You know, this is not a mistake. And I want to see what their next move is. It's interesting that Russia came out the other day and they're creating their own cryptocurrency. So everybody is finding, you know, so there's going to be ruble cryptocurrency, because ultimately if there are these electronic medium of exchange and what we call currency, it will be controlled by the governments. They will not let this out of their control. If they lose control of this, then, you know, look at one of the mainstays of the U.S. Constitution is the government's ability to, you know, for currency and coinage. Yeah. So they will lose control of it. But when we really look at it, and I think this is where John goes, because if we go back to the 1960s, the late 50s, the 60s, when Jacques Rouffe was writing The Sin of the Monetary Sin of the West, and he was calling into question, because what we had was not a gold standard, we had a gold exchange standard, that the United States was willing to exchange gold for currencies until, of course, the Vietnam War and the War on Poverty began. And then there was just too much currency hooks to change. So Nixon would have said, hey, they can kill us here, so we got to get off this standard. It's the same thing, really, if you look at Bitcoin. Bitcoin is nothing but a dollar exchange standard, because it's not like Bitcoins are their own currency. It's not like somebody's created a currency out of nothing. If you buy Bitcoins, you're exchanging some underlying value. You might be exchanging gold, but most of the time you're exchanging dollars for those Bitcoins, because they're always valued in dollars. The Chinese are really going to try hard to take us away from that. And I think John's point, and you know, Rich, I wrote about that too. I thought that was an amazingly important article, that what China is doing, and that we have to be very attentive to it.
And go ahead.
What Ira said, I think is so interesting, because what we've got is an illusion of wealth and an unreality. And that's the awful thing. These governments and central banks have just created this incredible unreality. And I mentioned those differences in yield, which are just beyond belief. But the thing is that when we go back to, say, the gold standard that we had before, there was real money because of the gold standard before the First World War. And what I find fascinating is that it had a rule of money. There was a sort of rule of law within money, but it translated into international rule of law. There was a rule of law. There was very few wars when the international currency came in based on gold. And it was only when we broke from gold that we suddenly unleashed huge amounts of unrest and irregularity and breaking of the law. I mean, the law is broken by the government all the time. I mean, just look at the illegal immigration. Look at this new secret funding of Obamacare. Illicit and unconstitutional, but it still was accepted by all these rhino politicians, you know, who are so corrupt. And it's corrupted the thing, and that populations are getting very violent, very depressed, angry with each other. It's a great shame, and I think it's because we live in a world of unreality. And Ira mentioned cryptocurrencies. Of course, this is a fantastic thing. A Bitcoin plus its blockchain methodology is an offer to clear the swamp, the financial swamp. I mean, President Trump is trying to clear the political swamp in America, but the financial swamp is almost more severe. And it offers the individual freedom from government, instant transactions under digital transactions at no cost, and a tremendous degree of anonymity. I think it's a fantastic revolution that's taking place, and that's Bitcoin, which, of course, is becoming the reserve currency, as it were, or reserve cryptocurrency of the roughly 1,200 cryptocurrencies. They all translate or measured against Bitcoin, and Bitcoin is measured in dollars at the moment. So it's a fascinating thing taking place, and blockchain, which is the technology behind it, is going to challenge governments and major corporations of how they do business. It's going to almost redefine, in my view, capitalism, because it's going to be a completely new way of doing it on blockchain, devoid of regulations, where there's so much more freedom of the individual. And I think we're heading for a time of phenomenal change in the financial world because of blockchain. And of course, all the big financiers, including Jamie Dimon, who I like tremendously and is a tremendous guy, but they're all decrying Bitcoin and all this stuff because it's such a threat to the financial system that we've got now, which is so expensive. And, you know, the average bank is charging you for everything. They used to do everything just to have your money on interest deposit. They used to give you a decent rate of interest, and all the services were free. Now you're charged for everything, even a wiring, $15 to wire money. It's just staggering when it's all digital stuff and very easy. I doubt if it costs 15 cents, but it's charged. Okay. And yeah. So all these things are going to change, in my view. If you just imagine 1850 compared to 1950, who could have imagined in 1850 electricity and machine guns and all this sort of stuff? I mean, it was fantastic change in life, and I think we're going to experience that in the next few years, and one of the leading things is going to be the technology behind Bitcoin, the blockchain. It's going to transform the world. I mean, it's going to really face these big corporate, not just governments, but corporations on their whole business models. I mean, you think the internet was bad enough for brick and mortar companies, and we're now seeing, but blockchain is phase two of the internet, and it's going to be an even bigger challenge for commerce and the whole of capitalism. So I think we're going to see a sort of reversal and a technological draining of the financial swamp. And of course, it has huge implications for the Wall Street, the City of London, and every other financial center. Because if I come along and I dial up Germany.com and I deposit $10,000 into an account there, which I've opened, and they do due diligence. Takes a few days to open the account because they check you out, know your customer. They do all that by regulation and to avoid money laundering, et cetera, et cetera. I put the $10,000 in and convert it into some Bitcoin, and that money has come out of the banking system. So no longer is it in deposit and leveraged up to make loans. It's gone. Into the banking system, it's dead money. And when this catches on, at the beginning, it was so difficult to get into Bitcoin and everything, but it's getting very simple now. And if you don't leave the money on an exchange, and some of these Bitcoin exchanges or crypto exchanges have been hacked, you put it in your wallet, it's entirely secure. And my God, you've got to remember your password, just like you have to remember your numbered account in Switzerland, or it vanishes. So the thing is going to change, and what it's going to do is create dead money in the banking system. In other words, taking deposits out of the banks, and they're going to be really strapped. So I think this is a, Bitcoin is a major, major economic threat to bursting the balloon. And then people with Bitcoin, of course, would rise phenomenally if money collapses, a fiat currency. It's the only way you can get into cryptocurrency is through Bitcoin. None of the other cryptocurrencies accept fiat money. You can put fiat money, in other words, dollars, into Bitcoin and then from Bitcoin into the other cryptocurrencies. But so this is going to siphon money out of the banking system. It's going to siphon money that people feel is real money. And a combination of, say, Bitcoin and gold, with the Bitcoin being much more mobile and easily moved around the world at no cost, is a thing I see of the future resulting from the swindle that people have been had by their governments and the banking system. And that's that could prick the balloon.
Speaking of the move away from dollars, we talked about the Chinese. Do you think the Russians may move away from accepting dollars for oil?
They already have done the deals with China. China, that was the ridiculous thing about forcing the Russians that Obama did over the Crimea. Instead of seeing that the Crimea was to Russia as the Cuba was to the United States under Kennedy, when Khrushchev put his missiles in there underneath the soft belly of America next to Florida, Kennedy had to get them out, even if it meant going to nuclear war. He simply couldn't accept those missiles sitting that close with such a short time fuse to get into the United States. He couldn't accept it. So he had to get it back. And luckily, Khrushchev realized that, climbed down, and the tit for tat was that America removed its missiles from Turkey, the soft underbelly of the United States. But Obama and Kerry hadn't read their history, and they didn't see that Crimea and Ukraine was a similar thing for Russia. And instead of accepting it and finding some weasel words typical of politicians to get over this problem, they forced Russia out and into the hands of the Chinese, where we've spent ages trying to lever them away from the Chinese. And now Russia makes no bones about being awkward with us. And one of the things they've done is tied up huge deals with China in their mutual currencies, and avoiding the U.S. dollar. So they're out. I mean, one of the things to break America, it's very interesting. We've piled up huge amounts of money in military systems and very advanced military. But maybe the Achilles heel for the Western world is its money, not its armed forces. Because if China could break the dollar and China and Russia could break the dollar, they'd smash America without firing a shot. And the great generals are the ones that win without actually fighting. You like chess, you threaten the king with a checkmate. You don't even have to take him. He can't move. And that's the game of the ultimate strategies, is to win with the minimum of fighting. And the Chinese could be doing that, etching at our currencies, fiat currencies. And when we talk in trillions, I mean, a billion is a lot to get your mind around. I mean, I've seen a football crowd at Wembley Stadium of 100,000, and that's a huge number. Billion is way out of my comprehension. I was heading to a funeral in South Korea. There were said to be a million people at the funeral. I was sitting next to Caspar Weinberger. Even then, you can only see the sides of the crowd. It's vast. You can't see a million. A trillion seconds ago was 31,500 years ago. An American government owes $20 trillion direct debt and about another trillion in unfunded liabilities and guarantees. So these are staggering figures, and people have no comprehension. It's the big game of bluff that's been run by the governments and the central banks. People, the ordinary people, have no idea. And if that bubble was to burst, the abject poverty that should be wreaked upon everyone as they search for what Ira said right at the very beginning, a search for market value, of real value, is so way below these prices in almost everything. And we said, what would China do next after oil? What about copper? Probably the most widely used natural resource in the world, other than water, of raw materials for production. It's copper. And if they do it for oil, for this instrument, why not do the same thing for copper? If the oil one is successful, and then gradually spread it around, who would be buying dollars to buy any commodities? You'd kill the dollar, and with the dollar, you'd kill the United States.
And Ira, what are your thoughts on the Russians moving away from accepting dollars for oil, the potential for that? You recently pointed out the Saudi king first ever official visit to Russia.
Yeah, John talked about that. He alluded to it. These are major events. These are so far more important, whatever Trump tweets. The Saudi king going to Russia, first time ever, that's an enormous event. That's a signaling event. That's a pivot. And when John talks about Obama and Kerry, they had no idea what was going on. Because I love when John talks about the Cuban Missile Crisis. Listen, boy, as I've said to anybody, go read. Probably the best book of political science was Graham Allison's The Essence of Decision. And you'd understand, first of all, everything that's going on in Washington anyway, because it's the greatest study of bureaucratic politics, and it acknowledges that. And in fact, he rewrote a version in 1999. I mean, it's brilliant. This is all that's going on. But Obama and Kerry dropped the ball. First, because the Russians are never going to give up the Crimea. You know, people don't understand. Why is there Guantanamo Bay in Cuba? Why does the United States still have a naval base in Cuba? Because Cuba protects New Orleans. And New Orleans is the grain shipping capital of the world. Cuba protects the entire Gulf of Mexico, which is huge for oil and food. Just like Crimea. If you look at a map, Crimea, and why did the Russians always want a base in Crimea? Because it allows it to either threaten or protect the whole Straits of Bosphorus. You know, forget Turkey. When the Russians want to shut that down, they can shut that down. And that's why you're not going to move them out of Crimea. But people don't ever look at a map, and so much of this becomes just logic. But the Russians learned a lot from Obama. You know, they first saw that red line, and they saw all the weaknesses and all the apologies and all the. So they just kept moving in. They just kept moving in and moving in. And when what's-her-name tried to excite she was the ambassador in Ukraine. I apologize. It'll come to me by the end, I guarantee you. And, she was trying to incite Putin with the whole revolution. Putin played that exactly. And then John McCain, the idiot. I'm sorry, John, I used to respect you. But when you want to give the Ukrainians advanced weaponry, you're setting them up for massacre because Putin was only waiting for that to happen. So you back off of that, and things have quieted in Ukraine because the Russians have the eastern part, and they have their people in, and it'll work itself through. But the world is fascinating, and all these things with the oil, the Russians are going to squeeze this too, which is why they're working with the Saudis, because the Saudis need the Russians now that the Russians are in control of Syria, and if they're going to prevent what the Saudis fear most, of course, is the Shia crescent that extends out of Iran across Iraq into Lebanon, with Hezbollah, and they want the Russians, because they know now the Russians are the key player there, not the United States. As soon as the Russians took back that naval base in Syria, it was a major game changer. And John Kerry, he was ridiculous. They had no plan, and they got totally blindsided by the events that unfolded. So all of this there, and to me, and I'm gonna, we'll see what John says about this. The greatest wild card in the game, the greatest wild card for the Russians, is Gerhard Schroeder. He has an enormous position. Now, it wasn't before, it was just the pipelines, but now they've actually brought him in, to Rosneft as a major director. Are you kidding me? This is a guy who was the chancellor. This would be like George W. Bush, serving on the board of Gazprom. You'd have to stand up and wait. There are things afoot here that are so big that nobody's paying attention to them, and they will unfold. What's going to be the market dynamic? I don't know, but I know these things are in motion, and we have to be very attuned to them.
Yes, that Gerhard Schroeder thing is fascinating, because obviously Russia and Germany have always had a huge trade. And when the sanctions came on organized by Obama, of course, the United States did less than a fifth of the amount of dollar volume trade with Russia than Germany did. And so it hurt Germany far more. And that threatened to break NATO, because the Germans didn't want to go ahead with these sanctions. That was a threat to NATO, would have split NATO, and that would have been very, very bad. But it risked it. And eventually Merkel kowtowed and obeyed what Obama and Kerry had wanted. But it was a dangerous time, and the Gerhard Schroeder thing illustrates this. And the great weakness. I'm appalled when I think, the government here is focused on trying to fix a Russian allegation on the president, and meddling around in these silly, unbelievable investigations of people while the big crooks go. And these huge events are happening in the world and nothing seems to be done. But I think people are getting really fed up, really fed up. They're sick of being financially swindled by their governments and seeing their living standards fall. I mean, now, when I first came to Wall Street in 1969, most people had one family breadwinner. Now both parents have to work to have a living wage. And yet this huge wealth, this illusion of wealth is there. But really at the grassroots level, ordinary people are being really squeezed to death. And I think they're getting very fed up with that, and also with their governments doing things that people now, thanks especially to the internet, are seeing things happen in the world which are totally against their interests, and the government are doing it. It started with a big rebellion in Britain with Brexit. It started, the second thing was the election of President Trump. The people spoke. The financial elite were absolutely staggered that he won, and as they were staggered by the victory of Brexit. And now you see Catalonia wanting to leave in Spain. You saw the same sort of problem in Greece, in Italy, and then in the German elections, the huge movement of the right from zero to 88 seats in the Bundestag. And from zero, with everybody just a month before the election saying, well, we'll never let one of them in. They'll never get one seat. They got 88 seats. And now you see in Austria the similar sort of thing. The people are speaking. And they're very, very fed up with their governments. And I believe, as I went back to that gold story, when you dilute and you create turmoil with the money system, it eventually spread into the political system. And where we had gold, there was law and order within money. And when that vanished, the law and order on the streets broke down. And in society, just the way of behavior, let alone the crime on the street. And it's now reached a fever pitch, and people who have to live on the street, I mean, our leaders live in limousine-driven, chauffeur-driven cars and police escorts and everything else. Ordinary people have to live with their children going to school down streets which are dangerous, and they're beginning to speak. And I think all these things are beginning to reach a crescendo, which is extremely worrying.
And Ira, you've written about the Sunday election in Austria as well. Wondering your thoughts on that. You also mentioned financial repression will be the next theme for the European right.
Oh, yeah, there's no question. And I know John, from what I've read of his and heard him speak, that's exactly, the media and the established elites and whatever that means, but it exists. And, I call it the Davos crowd, who meet amongst themselves and proclaim their own self-importance. But they want to make it into anti-immigration. It's so much more than that. If you pay attention, I mean, today, the German court decided, and I was, I read a little bit of the ruling from Carl's rule, and they basically sided with what the ECB is doing up to a point. But this isn't going to stay that way forever because, what's his name, who was the original founder of the AFD, Bernd, the economist, they were all economists. And yes, they got sidetracked, because Merkel made that terrible decision about open immigration and they attracted some. But there are things that are going to re-rise because they're not going to back off of this. And if the FDP is brought in and Linda gets the financial ministership, this is going to be a continued issue because German citizens are paying by design. By design, they are paying for the entire bailout of Europe. And yeah. You know what? Right now, because the world has enough growth, they're able to, to smooth it over. But that's not going to last long either. You know, Japan was able to go through a terrible period of non-growth or very low growth, but a lot of that was because the rest of the world was expanding. You know, so that alleviated a lot of problems. Japan had more problems, of course, when the world went into a major recession in 08, 09. You know, so these things, Ben Hunt, from Epsilon Theory writes about it continuously. It's the narrative. And do I accept the narrative that the mainstream, and it's not like I'm a fanatic, I'm not, but I read everything that I can, because I need to in order to prosper what I do. But I don't accept that narrative because there's underlying things that are far more powerful going on, and it's outside of the narrative that they want to concoct as the way the world is. And you know what? It's just not so. There's so much disruption going on. And now, we got the Chinese, their 5-year meeting with Xi and what will come out of there. And of course we have the Japanese elections. But the Austrian elections were very important because, as John was talking about, the rise of the right there, this is the second time. The first time was back, of course, when the euro was coming into existence and the Austrian people were not enamored with it. And what we got, Jörg Haider, who was shunned by the rest of Europe. It's harder to shun people now because you've got the Catalans, you've got Brexit. You've got Poland, who's not very happy with the way things are. You have other of the Eastern European members of the EU who are not very happy. There's a lot of underlying unhappiness, and Merkel is right now in a very wounded position. The only thing that can salvage her would be if she created another grand coalition with the SPD. But the SPD, who just won an election that they weren't supposed to do very well in, they have no desire. And they've said that, they'd rather, they do better as an out party than they do as a part of the coalition. So she's in a very precarious situation here. This will be interesting to watch.
John, your final thoughts, we're just coming up to a time crunch, but final thoughts by John?
Well, I think, just listening to Ira, I agree with everything he said. I mean, what I see happening now is that, as I've said before, I think my summary feeling is that we have this illusion of wealth based on really an illusion, and that we've built this massive bubble thanks to the Fed and the other central banks that have followed suit. Absolutely gigantic, trillions of dollars of hot air, really. And if that was to go, the higher you've gone, And the balloon goes, the more devastating the fall. And we are really high up at the moment. I mean, the 23,000 stock market and everything. I think it's just shocking the way people have been treated. What's really worrying is that people now are beginning to act. They've seen it. And if the balloon is pricked because of their actions on the street, and they get politicians in here that really will prick the balloon, it's going to be a very nasty financial situation.
Well, great insight, gentlemen. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Ira?
Well, Notes from Underground is available if you go to Ira Harris, YIRAHARRIS.com, and you and Notes from Underground will click up, and you can subscribe to it. It costs you less than a crypto coin. Oh, it costs nothing. Maybe one peso, maybe equivalent of a peso. Minimus. And so you can find me there, and there's a lot of dialogue that goes on.
And John?
Well, I write for Euro-Pacific Capital on their internet, which is europac.net, not .com, but europac.net. And my articles are on there together with those of Peter Schiff on the cover page. So that's probably the best way, other than lectures that I give every now and again. And, of course, your wonderful podcast.
Well, great. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for being on the show. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard, and thank you, Aaron.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Pleasure. Yeah, look forward to it again.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.